Thanks, and thanks for being here on this smoky evening. And wasn't able to hear back there in the back room, but I'm so glad that we're able to gather here this evening to hear the insights of somebody who's been covering the Middle East for several decades now, Reese Ehrlich, author of 5 books, the most recent of which is called The Iran Agenda Today, and the subtitle is The Real Story Inside Iran and What's Wrong with U.S. Policy. You know, it's one thing to read a bio or to see the credentials of somebody who's done professional work over the years, but I'm going to augment that with some firsthand observations after I mention that Reese got his start with Ramparts Magazine as a journalist in 1968. Those of us who are, I won't say old, so those of us who have been alive for a number of decades may well remember Ramparts Magazine as the crucial cutting-edge publication that it was. And Reese began his journalistic work as a staff writer and a research editor in San Francisco at Ramparts. And since then, he's done a tremendous amount of independent, and I stress independent, journalistic work, print and broadcast. So in that capacity, he's covered the Middle East since 1987 and Iran since the year 2000. He's done reporting for outlets like the Dallas Morning News, and also most recently for outlets such as Foreign Policy Magazine, Vice News, The Progressive Magazine. If you have the plus and minus experience of listening to programs like Morning Edition on NPR when you're commuting or in some other capacity, if you've done that very much, you've probably heard Reese's reports from various parts of the world, and he has that kind of expertise to be able to put together, whether he's covering jazz in Havana or cultural developments or political events around the world, to get it into that format. But as you'll see from his book, Reese is somebody who goes down deep into not only the cultural and psychological and political dynamics, but also he dispels a lot of the mythology that passes for news through mainstream coverage every day. And in that work, he won a Peabody Award. He also is currently writing a syndicated column called Foreign Correspondent, which you can catch in the Bay Area originating outlet called 48hills.org. Okay, well, that's Reese in terms of his CV and various credentials, but I want to tell you a little bit about what I've seen when I've seen Reese at work. We ended up on a plane going to Baghdad together in September of 2002. And Reese is a meticulous researcher. And so whether it's the first time or the 10th time he's gone to a faraway country, he really does that very in-depth search for many different sources. I saw how that manifested when he was in Iraq. I saw it when we were in Afghanistan. I saw it when we were in Iran. And it brings to mind the question of attitude and assumptions, which we're going to hear about, I think, tonight a fair amount. It's a reality of U.S. mass media, what passes for professionalism, that if you're pro-war, you're objective. If you're anti-war, you're biased. And Reese has never accepted that kind of paradigm. He's always been committed to searching for the deeper truths, not just the political spin, but also, and most importantly, the human realities. And for those and many other reasons, I'm very glad to be able to introduce to you Reese Ehrlich.
Thank you all very much. I didn't hear a word of what was just said. I assume it was nice. A number of people have commented about my hat. I've started a tradition now of each new book, I have a new hat. And I realized in the poster that was for tonight's event, I don't know if you saw it, they kind of distort a photograph, and it made me look like I'd just gotten off the boat from Sicily. I was wearing this hat. And I do want to tell you how I got it. It was a gift from my father. And it was, he sat me down one day and said, Reese, I bring back three things from the old country, a clump of dirt from our farm, a cutting for the grapes to grow the grapes, and this hat which I want you to have from Sicilia. And I turned to him and there was a tear in my eye and I said, Dad, why are you talking this way? We're Jewish. It's a very old joke, but so old I can't even remember who I stole it from. Imagine just for a moment a hypothetical situation that there was a country in the world that had invited one of its nationals to a consulate in a third country, and lured there, he was murdered brutally, and the murder was exposed, and that country then came up with four different excuses as to what had happened, ultimately admitting that it was a premeditated murder of this person from that country. And imagine just for a moment that that country was not Saudi Arabia, but Iran. Imagine the reaction in the United States, the calls for overthrowing the government, the human rights violations, the outrage, the congressional resolutions, the stepped-up sanctions from Washington, etc. But of course, it wasn't in the case of the Saudi Arabia. To date, there have been two things done against the people who were charged with the murder. One was they are not allowed to, their visas were canceled, so they can't visit the United States. They are no longer able to visit Disney World. And the other, more recently, was to allege, at least they say they're going to stop refueling the Saudi planes bombing Yemen. Now we'll see if that's in fact carried out. But these are very weak responses given the outrageous nature of what the Saudi government had done, and it reached up to the highest levels of the Crown Prince. Now, we don't have to actually speculate as to what the U.S. might have done had it been Iran instead of Saudi Arabia. We know actually, we can see from a parallel case. About 5 years ago, the U.S. government accused Iran of conspiring to murder the Saudi ambassador to Washington. And they claimed there was an Iranian national who they never arrested, that he was back in Iran, and there was an Iranian American who ultimately pled guilty and is serving time for it. But nobody was actually killed. It was an alleged conspiracy, and it was never linked conclusively to Iran itself. At the time of the arrests, the U.S. Senate, 92 senators, wrote a letter to President Obama demanding that he take action against the Iranian government and that he crush the Central Bank of Iran. Where are the calls now to hear somebody was actually murdered, not an alleged conspiracy of a murder that never took place, but an actual murder, and where are the calls to crush the Central Bank of Saudi Arabia? So, of course, there's a complete double standard when it comes to U.S. policy. It's not the only part of the world, but it's one in which I've spent a fair amount of time now writing and researching and writing books and articles and radio reports. And the U.S. is interested in the part of the world because not out of concern for human rights, but because the Middle East, of course, is one of the major suppliers of oil. Saudi Arabia has probably the largest or the second largest amount of oil reserves. Iran is very high up there, number three or four. The Strait of Hormuz controls the oil shipments that come out of Iraq and Iran. It's a geopolitical area. It's an economic area, and that's why there's so much concern. That's why there's so much effort to change the government in Iran and bring back a pro-U.S. regime, as had happened one time before. I want to take you back for a moment, and Norman will remember this. He gave me a call one day I was just sitting in my home office and minding my own business, and Norman called and he said, how would you like to go to Iran with Sean Penn? And I said, I considered it for several nanoseconds. I said, sure. What's he want to do? What are we going to do? It turns out Sean wanted to understand how ordinary Iranians, what they thought about the U.S., the U.S. government, the U.S. people. And Norman knew I had been to Iran before and had some contacts and knew how I operated. It was 2005, so it was at the time of the presidential elections. So after some difficult work, it's always tricky getting a journalist visa to go to Iran. Sean actually went as a journalist, not as a movie star. He wanted to write up his experiences there, and in fact he did in a five-part series in the San Francisco Chronicle that he wrote up after we got back. And he asked me, it was one question I really remember in several meetings that we had, he said, are people going to know my work over there? I said, oh yeah, they're going to know you. And even though the movie theaters can't play American movies or Sean Penn's movies or anybody else's, they have a wide-ranging underground DVD market. And they have what they call DVD men. It's a walk-in video store. He comes by your house every week and brings the latest DVDs that they've copied from elsewhere in the world, pirated, and then you select what you want. And apparently Sean's movies were among the more popular ones. In fact, when we were doing some interviews in the bazaar, the famous Tehran bazaar, Sean walked up to one merchant, you know, while we were doing some interviews, and the guy was flabbergasted. He says, why, I know you, you're Sean Penn. You used to be married to Madonna. The outreach of Hollywood. And so we actually had some very interesting interchanges. We spent a lot of time talking with ordinary people, stopping people on the street, going to the University of Tehran, meeting with candidates, etc., and got a pretty good sense. And the overwhelming sense that we had, I've had on all my trips, and in fact any American who goes to Iran will tell you the same, is the Iranian people are incredibly friendly to Americans. You'd think, given everything that this country has done to them, that there would be some anger or antagonism. But they really do make a distinction between the people and the government of the United States. I'll be stopping to talk to somebody on the street and hear me speak in English or even in a museum, and someone will come up and say, oh, where are you from? And I said, I'm from San Francisco. I'm actually from Oakland, but nobody in the world's ever heard of Oakland. So I'm from San Francisco, and they say, oh, I have a cousin. He lives in San Jose. Or I have a brother-in-law. He lives in Glendale. Or, you know, immediately you're off onto a geographical discussion because they, you know, and I visited once. And so there's a great deal of friendliness to Americans. And they, of course, want to know how come we voted for Trump. But that's a question that we ask ourselves as well, right? So there's incredible friendliness. Partly it's just cultural, that it's friendliness to all strangers, and partly it's because there were a lot of Iranians who went to school here in the 70s and were part of the anti-Shah movement. Some of them went back, and they sometimes either directly talking to them or their children, they have very fond memories of interacting with the American people. Now compare that with how the United States government whips up anger and whips up sentiment towards war. We pay lip service to making a distinction between the people and the government, but in reality, we want you to get angry at those Middle Easterners. All of those Iranians, all of those Iraqis, all those Afghanis, they're all terrorists, and they're going to come after you like they did on 9/11, and you better be prepared. No distinction between government and ordinary people. And that helps, of course, to impose U.S. policy on the region. The Obama administration, in one of the few good things, in my opinion, that it did in terms of foreign policy, did negotiate an agreement on the nuclear, what we know as the nuclear accord. It arranged, at tremendous sacrifice by the Iranians, as well as compromises by the U.S., to stop permanently the possibility of any development of a nuclear bomb in Iran. And all nuclear facilities will be used for making, you know, nuclear power. And they're, in fact, not only did it was agreed to, they're still carrying it out even today. then there are International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors, cameras, and other provisions. It's the most intrusive inspection regime ever created in the history of the world, according to the head of the IAEA, Mr. Yuki Amano. That didn't stop Trump, of course. He had his own motivations, which was to partly because he hated everything that Obama did, partly because he's part of that camp in Washington, in the ruling elite that really believes you can overthrow the government of Iran and somehow there'll be a pro-U.S. regime that emerges out of it. So when he withdrew from the nuclear accord, it was a huge blow for the United States, actually, because the U.S. has lost credibility not only with Iran, but remember there were a total of 7 signatories to the agreement, including Europeans and Russia and China. And the question is now asked, well, if the U.S. withdrew from that treaty, what's to prevent them from withdrawing from any other treaty? Why should anybody negotiate with the U.S.? And I know the North Koreans are thinking that. Supposedly, this close friendship between Trump and Kim Jong-un is meaningless. The North Koreans want to know, if somehow you can reach an agreement, how do we know you're going to even stick to it? And indeed, the hardliners in Iran, I was there reporting in the period after the nuclear accord had been reached, but it hadn't been signed by either side, and there was a lot of debate in Iran. And the hardliners were arguing, don't go for it. You can't trust the Americans. What if after Obama leaves office, a new president comes in and pulls out of the accord? And the argument was, oh, well, that can't happen. You know, ha, ha, ha. So actually, the impact of the new sanctions and the changes made by Trump has been to strengthen the hardliners in Iran, the people who want to see perpetual antagonism towards the U.S., who want to see expansion of Iranian power in the region, who are the most repressive when it comes to cracking down on women's rights, on ethnic minority rights, on any civil liberties or human rights in Iran. These are the folks who get strengthened by these kinds of U.S. actions. The impact, though, and I'm going to explain this a little bit more towards the end, has been exactly the opposite of what Trump had proclaimed. The people of the world are so angry, and the people of Iran are so angry, there are very serious economic problems in Iran, partly because of the newly imposed sanctions, partly because of mismanagement and corruption in Iran. I on all of my trips, I've now been to Iran 10 times, and I always try to stop people on the street, ordinary people. And I go to North Tehran, which is where the more well-to-do people live. I go to South Tehran, where the working class folks live. And they always have a minder with you when you're doing reporting. That is an employee of a government, quasi-government agency that translates and sets up interviews, but they also report back on who you meet with and what the content of the interviews are. And so by stopping people at random on the street, you can't be fed information that only the government that the government wants you to see. You get a chance to, if you interview enough people, you get a sense on your own of what's really going on. And in all of the interviews that I've talked to people, several things emerge. There's a tremendous hatred of corruption that particularly the Revolutionary Guards and the intelligence agencies are incredibly corrupt. They control the airports, the seaports, which is where all the smuggling goes. So if you want to get fine alcohol, brand name alcohol, or good French wine, it comes through the Revolutionary Guard, who skims some money off the top. Of course, alcohol is illegal in Iran. It's a dry country, unless you're one of the non-Muslim minorities, in which case you can make it at home. But buying brand name liquor is certainly illegal, but easily available. The other thing that people complain about is the lack of civil liberties and human rights. I've been to a number of demonstrations. Norman, Sean, and I in 2005 attended a peaceful, silent demonstration by women in front of the University of Tehran. They were simply sitting on the sidewalk, not blocking anybody, not saying anything, to protest the lack of women's rights in Iran. And the Basiji and the plainclothes police came up and just broke it up, brutally broke it up, started just wailing on people, et cetera. And that there's a great deal of resentment about that. Let me just briefly mention, because I've had this discussion with Iranian friends and Iranian government officials, and they say, oh, well, you don't know anything. I mean, the people in the West and your reporters don't know anything about women's rights here. We have a majority of our students are women. A sizable number of the university professors are women. And by that, I meant the university students, a majority of university students are women. They talk about the fact that there are some, at least one vice president and other high government officials who are women. And I say, compare that with Saudi Arabia or Bahrain, where women's rights are completely negated, where you know women and men have to be in separate rooms when they're studying at the university and so on and so forth. And I turn to them and I say, well, you know, comparing yourself to Saudi Arabia is a pretty low bar. That's right. You treat women better than Iran, but that doesn't mean that women are anything close to equal. And they still face a lot of discrimination in terms of inheritance laws, in how they're treated by the judicial system in general, and a whole list of complaints that the women, and that they actively fight for and protest. The other general area is economics. And this has come to the fore, particularly in the last year or two. In December of last year, January of this year, there were very large, very militant demonstrations, mostly by workers. And this was quite different. In 2009, you may remember the Green Movement that gained a lot of publicity, had millions of people marching in the streets. At a certain point, that was mostly kind of middle income, intellectuals, students, professors, those kind of folks, folks from North Tehran. These demonstrations last year and early this year were working class folks. They were protesting the fact that they would be working at a factory and they hadn't been paid for 3 months, 4 months. And then the government-owned factory was shut down and they had no wages. All the back pay had disappeared. And people were quite angry. And very quickly, the economic protest became political because the police come in, various intelligence agencies come in, they beat people up, they arrest people, they torture people, and their demands for the freedom of those leaders and so on. So most recently, there was a nationwide or almost nationwide teacher strike, again, mostly focused on improving wages and working conditions. And the head of the lead protester in Tehran was arrested and put in a mental hospital where he was shot full of drugs. That's an old trick from the old Soviet Union in the old days, where your protest leaders are not legitimate protest leaders. They must be crazy for doing what they're doing. So there are plenty of things to complain about in Iran, and I have written extensively about the problems that stem from the nature of the Islamic State. It is not, as they claim, a democracy. It is a repressive society, but it's one that the Iranian people are perfectly capable of dealing with in their own time and in their own way. And I've yet to meet a single Iranian in all my trips who says, ah, yes, we hate our government. What we need is the U.S. to come in and tell us what to do. You know, that seems to be something they can't figure out in Washington. The neocons now, especially John Bolton, Mike Pompeo, and the others, they really do believe that if they squeeze the Iranian people enough, and they fund terrorist groups, particularly among the ethnic minorities, that they can overthrow the government and the people will welcome a pro-US regime. And the Iranians tell me, and they tell anybody else who cares to listen, is we went through that once. In 1953, we had what you would call a democratic government. The Prime Minister Mossadegh allowed freedom of the press, freedom of religion, free elections, freedoms to demonstrate, and that duly elected government decided to nationalize British Petroleum, the British monopoly that had been set up between the British and the corrupt Shah of years past, and basically said, "You're going to sell us all your oil at prices that we dictate." And the Iranians, Mossadegh said no. we're going to nationalize the oil and we'll actually let you keep 50%, but we're going to take 50%. And the British were outraged. And they said, you know, we cheated you fair and square. We demand, you know, we have a signed contract by this corrupt Shah that says, you know, you have to sell us the oil. So the British went to Truman, who turned down the request to overthrow Mossadegh. But when Eisenhower came in and the Dulles brothers became the head of the CIA and the head of the State Department, then the argument was, oh, Mossadegh is so weak and unstable, it's going to lead to a communist revolution. And therefore, you have to join with us in getting rid of Mossadegh. And the CIA then proceeded to carry out and use every terrorist tactic in the book to overthrow the legitimate democratic government in Iran. So they carried out assassinations and bombings and everything that we now accuse other people of doing and calling them terrorists, we did. There's an excellent book on this. Stephen Kinzer wrote it called All the Shah's Men. If you haven't had a chance to read it, you might want to check it out. It's a very good monologue, mono-a-mono. Anyway, it's a good book, and it details this history. At this point in my talk, sometimes people feel like, well, you've laid out all of these problems in the U.S. and all these problems in Iran, and I think I'm pretty depressed. I think I'll just go home and pull the covers up over my head, and that'll be it. But I say, take heart, that I'm actually rather optimistic, and I'll explain to you why. Because Trump's policies are actually backfiring, and we're seeing it happen already. So on November 4th, he was going to told the world that Iran would no longer be able to export any of its oil. It will be zero exports. And it was going to be done by the U.S. imposing very harsh sanctions on any country that deigned to accept Iranian oil. November 4th came and went. Lo and behold, the Trump administration allowed seven countries to actually export oil to Iran, including the three largest importers of Iranian oil, China, India, and Turkey, plus a number of other countries. And the excuse was, oh, well, we let them import the oil because otherwise there would have been a spike in oil prices. That was the excuse. The real reason was they were going to import the oil anyway. In other words, there is not the international support. In fact, there's almost no international support, and there's no international support at all among significant countries that would back up Trump's plans. So he had to give them a waiver for 6 months. China is in the process of setting up a bank that has no banking relations whatsoever with the United States, and therefore can't be sanctioned by the United States. It would deal with the oil issues between China and Iran. The European countries, France, Britain, Germany, and some others, are setting up a special purpose vehicle, it's called, where they can import Iranian oil and then ship finished products to Iran, but none of the trades are done in U.S. dollars and none are done through U.S. banks. And that would, they hope, get around the ability of the United States to impose sanctions on them. If they set that up, that's a very big deal, because the anger by the Europeans against the United States is not just about the Iran question. This actually first came up with the U.S. tried to impose the embargo of Cuba on the Europeans. The Europeans have always traded with Cuba, but the U.S., of course, unilaterally decided that it was going to make Castro fall, right? We saw how successful that was. And they went and tried to sanction or threatened to sanction European countries if they traded with Iran, with Cuba. So they had started to talk about this special purpose vehicle even back then. And now it's gotten a new impetus. So you add on top of the disputes over the sanctions, the craziness of Trump attacking every ally at every opportunity. Anybody who knows anything about politics is you attack an enemy, you isolate the enemy, and gather as many allies around you as you can to attack that enemy, right? He does the exact opposite. He attacks everybody in order to get everybody as ticked off as possible. Anger, he ticked off. Mexico, Canada, Britain, France. I mean, he's picking a fight with Macron. And in many cases, these are conservatives. These are people who agree with him ideologically, like Macron in France or Theresa May in Britain. But it doesn't matter. So he's imposing tariffs. He's started a major trade war with China. And then at the same time expects China to help the U.S. negotiate with North Korea or help the U.S. deal, you know, with its sanctions against Iran. So I don't know who's feeding him information in Washington, but in the real world, when you get out and actually talk to people and see what countries are doing, there's a great deal of anger at what Trump is doing. And it's also setting the basis in the long term for the end of the U.S. dollar being the international trade currency. Right now, the U.S. is the strongest currency in the world. It means that people buy U.S. Treasury bonds because they're easily purchased in dollars. If the dollar is either not used or used to some lesser extent, it's going to have a huge impact. And China, Russia, and some other countries are talking about setting up alternative baskets of currency so that they can do their trading in dollars. And all of this attempts to unilaterally impose sanctions for anybody trading in U.S. dollars is an incentive, is pushing people in that direction. The other reason that I'm optimistic is the results of the midterm elections. As we see the results coming in, I know some people were concerned election night, but as we've seen the election results come in, the Democrats did pretty good. 35 or so seats in the House flipped. What looked like was going to be a rout in the Senate has turned out to be, we still don't know the results of the Senate race in Mississippi and Florida. But at worst case, it would be 53-47, Republican to Democrat. In the best case, it would be 51-49, which is what it is now. So while they still control the Senate, it's not the strength that they thought they were going to get and claimed initially. A number of very hardliners on foreign policy, and particularly anti-Iran folks, Rohrabacher out of San Diego and Barbara Comstock out of Virginia, lost their seats. Two Muslim American women won their seats and have taken a very good stand on Middle East issues. And there's a whole bunch of other folks. I'm in the process of doing some research to try and it's a mixed bag overall, because some quite centrist to right wing in the Democratic Party context folks are going to be taking over in the Foreign Policy Committee and some of the other committees in the House. So there's going to be a struggle within the Democratic Party as to what kind of foreign policy we're going to have. But at least the Democrats are in a position to stop the most egregious efforts by Trump, whether it be to demolish health care or to build a wall. And those things are dead. And I think the potential for the House Democrats to really push to the left on foreign policy is very great. So just one example, Ro Khanna, the representative, House representative from the San Jose area, introduced a War Powers Act resolution to stop the U.S. support for the war in Yemen. And it has 77 co-sponsors. And it was such a threat that Paul Ryan, the lame duck chair of the House, has done some parliamentary maneuvering to keep it from coming to a straight up or down vote, which is normally what a War Powers Act resolution has to do. If he does that and succeeds in it, there's still a chance of just bringing it up again in January. The House actually, even under Republican leadership, actually voted in favor of the War Powers Act to end the U.S. war and participation in the war in Yemen late last year. The Senate voted on it also, and it lost by 10 votes. It was 55-45 vote. But that, given, is not a bad split given the dominance of the Republican Party. So I think we're going to see increased efforts, particularly around Yemen, given the assassination of Khashoggi and other anger at what the Saudis are doing in Yemen. And I don't think ultimately it's going to be resolved in the halls of Congress, because it could take a two-thirds vote if the president vetoes it, and I don't think you're going to see that in the Senate and probably not in the House either. But the fact that it's even being submitted and debated is a reflection of the anger of people around the world and in the United States towards U.S. policy. And I think if, to the extent we build a grassroots movement that is able to combat these wars, this aggression, these sanctions, I think we stand a much better chance to do that now than we did very recently. So I am optimistic, a lot more optimistic today than I was 1 week ago. Thank you all very much.
I'm very glad to introduce now Angela Yip. She's from the staff of State Senator Nancy Skinner.
Hi, good evening, everyone. My name is Angela. I work for State Senator Nancy Skinner. And just on behalf of Senator Skinner, we wanted to send a huge congratulations and thank you to Reese for his many, many years of work uncovering the truth and providing necessary and critical commentary that we so often need in this country and throughout the world. So I have this resolution authored by Senator Skinner honoring Reese and his industrious career and leadership in the East Bay. And if I may, I'll just read a little piece of it.
Why don't you just step away from it? Just step here.
Sure. Okay.
Why don't you stand here? I'll stand over here.
Perfect. So, whereas the recipient of numerous awards and accolades, Reese Ehrlich won a shared Peabody Award in 2006 for the radio documentary series Crossing East and an award for Best Radio Explanatory Journalism from the Society of Professional Journalists. In 2012 for his radio documentary Inside the Syrian Revolution, and was singularly honored by the San Francisco Board of Supervisors for his investigative journalism with their declaration of Reese Ehrlich Day on September 14, 2010. Now, therefore, be it resolved by State Senator Nancy Skinner that she takes great pleasure in commending Reese Ehrlich with his half century of consequential contributions to broadcast and print reporting and the craft of journalism, and extends her sincere best wishes for the success of his future worthy endeavors. So thank you so much, Reese.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
I want to read one thing. I just wanted to briefly comment. This was not a complete surprise. But I did not know what the wording of this was going to be until they presented it. I want to read another section because I think it's quite telling. Whereas Ehrlich and six other activists known as the Oakland Seven organized Stop the Draft Week in October 1967 as an Oakland Induction Center-focused anti-war Vietnam protest supported by thousands of demonstrators, which quickly revealed the magnitude of the extremely polarizing, bitter discord arising out of the Vietnam conflict and led to the Oakland Seven being tried for and ultimately acquitted of criminal conspiracy, all of which presaged the kinds of events and topics Reese would examine in depth during his career as broadcast and print reporter. What struck me about this was 50 years later, we were recognized by the California State Senate for organizing a demonstration that at the time was denounced by everybody. And my only wish is that today's legislators, whether at the state or the federal level, don't take 50 years to realize the necessity of stopping the wars in Yemen and Iraq and Syria and Afghanistan. Yeah, thank you so much. Thank you very much. Okay, we're gonna do, I'm done.
There we go. Okay, so we're getting questions from the audience. Welcome, everybody. Appreciate you coming out and braving the smoke. It is really bad today. Well, I'll go ahead and start off. Amazing book. It was just beyond interesting. And I just remember as a kid in 79, just a little kid, and seeing on TV the hostages and just not quite understanding what was going on. You know, like, Dad, why can't they go home? Why can't they go home? You know, and hearing that spin and growing up with that spin of what Iran was about as far as the United States is concerned. And then reading this book and finally getting the full story and getting a fuller understanding of the people there, from the people in the bazaar to the upper echelons, the hierarchy of their political structure there. But let's start with this. You say here, so what are the real reasons for U.S. hostility? And you break it up into three sections: geopolitics, oil, and then military presence. Mm-hmm. Can you expound on that?
Sure. Yeah, what we're seeing, not only in Iran, but around the world, it's the system of imperialism is multi-pronged. It's not just economics, although that plays a key role. So if you start in the case of Iran, you have oil amongst the largest reserves in the world. And in order to make sure that U.S. oil companies can develop the fields and profit from the oil, you need to have a government that's pro-U.S., so it's economic and political. In order to protect the pipelines and the sea lanes, you need to have military bases and army bases to keep the government in power, to keep whoever the enemy du jour is away from their sea lanes. And you're not only do you want to keep your oil companies running things, you want to prevent whoever the enemy du jour is from them controlling the oil fields. So it's not about self-sufficiency in oil here at home. We could be self-sufficient in oil completely, not have to import any oil whatsoever, and the U.S. would still be interfering in the Middle East, because it's about making the maximum possible profits for the oil companies and denying that control to whoever the enemy is. And then once you control the politics, the economics, and the military, you control the culture. So you ship American movies and TV shows to the region to prove how great America is and how inferior your culture is. And I had a very bizarre experience recently. I was in Beirut, and I stopped to see a movie. And the movie was Rich Asians. What's the full title?
Filthy Rich Asians.
Crazy Rich Asians, which is a movie made in the United States, a Hollywood movie, featuring American and some other people of Asian origin about a family in Singapore that is one of the ruling Chinese families of Singapore. And I'm watching it in Beirut with French and Arabic subtitles. And I come out of the movie theater, I didn't know where I was. So, but that, and every, in this megaplex movie theater, virtually every movie playing was an American movie of some kind. And that's, you know, it plays the cultural, ideological role to back up all of those other elements of what I was talking about.
All right. Let's see, we got some really, really good ones here. Let's go with this one. We are seeing a progressive anti-nationalist, anti-racist, pro-women, and economic equality groups within Christian evangelical movements. Are there similar progressive egalitarian groups and forces organizing within Islamic communities in Iran?
Well, there certainly is a lot of dissent and protest in Iran. I wouldn't say it's exactly parallel to what was just described for the evangelicals here, but for sure there are, I would describe, three main trends in the opposition. or in Iranian politics in general. So there are people who like the system the way it is, who believe that the Islamic system is both anti-imperialist and, by that they mean, rejects not only the things I've been describing, but alcohol and women who dress provocatively and all these other conservative, that they oppose gays, being gay is illegal, although being transgender is not, interestingly enough, in Iran. But being if you are openly gay or if you're known to be gay, it's very dangerous in Iran. So there's the people who pretty much like the system the way it is. There's people who want to see significant changes, but within the Islamic constitution. That is to keep the Islamic system, but eliminate what they say are the excesses. So that would mean allowing couples to hold hands in public. It would mean not cracking down and arresting people, no matter what protests they make. And then there are people who say, no, the problem is with the Islamic constitution and the Islamic system itself. You can't have democracy and this kind of constitution, because under the constitution, ultimately there's one supreme leader who decides everything. There's president, there's parliament, there's other elected officials, but the supreme leader decides everything, allegedly based on his interpretation of Islam. And the minute you have that system, it's not going to work. And they are, some of the opponents are monarchists, they want to bring back the son of the Shah. Others are nationalists, like Mossadegh, out of that trend, who wanted to see some kind of return to that system. There, I've even met some independent Marxists. So, you know, there's different opposition, but they break down in a broad sense into those camps.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's see here. I agree that the U.S. response to the Saudis' assassination of Jamal Khashoggi was weak, if not pitiful. Do you think other official international responses has been any better?
Well, Erdogan in Turkey has sure been fired up about it. Mm-hmm. he's actually been playing a very clever game. Erdogan, you know, is arrests and mistreats journalists all over the place. He's at war with the Kurds inside Turkey as well as in neighboring Syria. I mean, he is a big-time violator of human rights. But he is really shrewd, and he has his competition going with Saudi Arabia. So, you know, we hear a lot about the Saudi-Iranian competition in the region, but there's also competition with Turkey. And by cleverly introducing the murder of Khashoggi, by letting out certain information, allowing the Saudis to make up stories, and then nailing them with what really happened, like, say, a good prosecutor would do in a court cross-examination. He's been very, very clever and frankly, more decisive in the response to the United States. So that would be one example. I think some of the European countries have also taken stronger stance.
Okay, let's see here. Well, this person has been to Iran in 2007 and in 2010. And hoping to return in January with a Code Pink peace delegation. Good. Yay.
We need more of that.
Yeah. All right.
Was there a question associated with that?
I think so. There's two. Oh. Do you think I will be safe?
Ah.
And the second one is, do you think we might make a positive difference? Thank you.
I'll answer the second question first. Yes, I think it makes a positive difference. As much by what you do when you come back to tell people about what you saw in Iran and the Iranian people you met, as it would be for what you're doing in Iran. Iran actually has a lot of tourists, not so many from the US, but there's a lot of Europeans and, of course, people from other Middle Eastern countries. There's a lot of religious tourism to the various Shia shrines. So they're not, I mean, they are accustomed to having tourists. And I think you will. I've actually led some tour groups myself to Iran, and I think you'll have a good time. It's a fascinating country. That's a good chance to meet ordinary people. The question of are you safe, partly that depends on whether you're an Iranian-American or an American-American, if you follow what I mean. Iranian-Americans, unfortunately, have been singled out on occasion by the Iranian government. for arrest because they think they're spies. And so there's a couple of different Iranian-American, well, the most infamous case, well, several, was the three hikers, you know, who were kidnapped basically by the Iranians and held in jail. Jason Rezaian, the Washington Post reporter. So that is a potential problem. It's not like every Iranian-American gets arrested. There's thousands that go back to visit family, and we never hear about them, and everything's fine. But it's a higher risk. To my knowledge, there have been no American-Americans, I don't know what you want to call people who are not of other ethnic origins, who go to Iran all the time and come back, and there's no problems.
All right. This one is, in regards to war, is there a serious danger of a U.S., Israeli, Saudi Arabian, and its Persian Gulf allies militarily attacking Iran? So I guess they're asking if they're a trifecta would.
Right. I think that is a greater danger than it was before Trump came to power. I think under Obama and with the nuclear accord, that danger was much lessened. But the Pentagon understands that to bomb Iran is extremely serious and that it would not have the desired effect. In other words, you can't just go and bomb Iran and the government is overthrown and the U.S. marches in. You would have, and the Pentagon has gamed out plans. We know in 2007, Seymour Hersh wrote a really good article in the New Yorker detailing what the Pentagon plans were, and it involved massive onslaughts on all of the, not just the nuclear sites, but the all the military bases, the headquarters in Tehran, an invasion force of thousands of U.S. troops that would go and probably have to occupy the country. And I don't think the U.S., and certainly not Israel and Saudi Arabia, are prepared for that. Saudi Arabia can't even win a war against the Yemeni Houthis, who have very little in the way of high tech or and is a much more divided society. An outside invasion or bombing would unite the Iranian people against the outside invader. They had that happen once with the Iraq war, the war with Iraq in the 80s. So I think that the folks in the Pentagon are smart enough to understand that. So I think what we will see more likely, although I don't rule that out, I think more likely is using ethnic minorities and others to carry out terrorist actions inside Iran in hopes of weakening the Tehran government. And we've seen some examples of that lately. The Revolutionary Guard in Ahvaz, which is the Arab, Iran, there's an ethnic Arab minority in Iran. And they, there was a couple months ago a military parade that was shot up by people dressed in Revolutionary Guard outfits and killed a number of soldiers and civilians in the stands. There was a less publicized incident of seven Revolutionary Guards being kidnapped in the Baluch area of Iran, which is over by the Pakistani border. And there's a Baluch minority. And the seven Revolutionary Guards were kidnapped and probably taken into Pakistan by some armed group. So things like, and there's been long time struggles in Kurdistan, in the Kurdish region of Iran. So there are very legitimate grievances that the ethnic minorities in Iran have against the central government, having to do with the use of their own language and education in their own language and many other issues, local media, et cetera. But the U.S. is trying to take advantage of that by funding and training these kinds of terrorist groups.
Reese, you mentioned some of the major factors in why the U.S. government has been so hostile and threatening action against Iran, the geopolitical, the economic, oil, and so forth. And I wanted to ask you a bit more about how that has played out in the U.S. I mean, I suppose we're now in our just about 40th year since the takeover of the U.S. embassy and the hostages, and thanks to Ted Koppel and ABC and other U.S. media, just became a drumbeat. On the other hand, the Vietnam War was obviously hugely consequential with enormous suffering, and now the U.S. is, you know, trading and all that with Vietnam. So there's there are these other aspects that make it seem, if not intractable, at least extremely dug in, that somehow not only the neocons or the liberal interventionists, but it seems that it's almost impossible to find a member of Congress in Washington willing to depart from hostility to Iran. The best you can get is, well, they're terrible, but we need to do X, Y, Z rather than do A, B, C. Yeah. How deep does this go in terms of hostility from the U.S. to Iran? And not to ask you to be overly optimistic, but how do you see this possibly changing significantly?
I think you're right. I've had a chance to meet with officials in Washington, State Department folks, speak at some right-wing think tanks. And it's a big, I actually met Scooter Libby, if you remember him, and a few folks of that ilk. They still populate the gaggle around Washington. And you have, from liberals to conservatives, there is a consensus that Iran is evil. Iran is the number one sponsor of terrorism in the world. In fact, it's arguably the United States, or certainly if you don't want to call it the United States, it's Saudi Arabia. So you're right, there is that consensus. And I don't think they're going to change on their own. I think they will only change when there's a grassroots fire from below. And at the moment, I think we may see it around the question of Yemen, because the U.S. direct links to what's going on in terms of terrorist attacks in Iran are not yet obvious. They haven't yet been publicized. But we can all see the horrors of the Yemen war, the famine, the cholera epidemics, the constant bombing of civilians, and so on. And that's why I mentioned the War Powers Act. But if I think all of these issues are interconnected, because Iran is backing the Houthis. And objectively, if the Saudis have to pull out and the U.S. stops the war in Yemen, that's going to be a positive for, as seen in Tehran. So I think the potential of changing U.S. policy towards Iran will be both directly taking on the issue of Iran, but also fighting against the Saudi occupation of Yemen.
And a related, or another piece of the puzzle, the state in, along with Saudi Arabia, with the state that is second to none with hostility in the Middle East towards Iran is Israel. Mm-hmm. And I want to ask you your ballpark assessment. How much of the fervent hostility towards Iran that's so embedded in the U.S. news media and on Capitol Hill and White House, how much of that is driven by the Israeli government agenda?
How much of the Washington?
How much the hostility from Washington to Iran is driven by Israel's hostility to Iran?
Well, they're interconnected, is what I would say. I don't think Israel controls U.S. policy on the Middle East or Iran, but they certainly, and we saw that when the Israeli, Netanyahu strongly opposed the nuclear accord, and it went through anyway, and Obama was had enough cojones to stand up to Netanyahu on that and implement it anyway. But now that Trump is in power, they're much more ideologically and every other way in collusion and agreement. And so Israel is happy to go along. Interestingly enough, when I visit Israel and I interviewed former government officials and think tank officials, they will acknowledge that Iran is not the existential threat to Israel that's claimed by the Israeli government. That Iran doesn't have nuclear weapons, and even if it did, would not use them in an offensive attack on Israel. That the Israeli government knows that if Iran has missiles and rockets that could land in Israel and could cause a lot of damage, conventional weapons, but they don't use them. And the reason is because it would give the excuse to Israel and the United States to flatten Iran. That would be the perfect excuse to wage war. And the people running the Iranian government are not crazy. They are not self-destructive. So the Israeli government use the same hype for their own people and for people in the United States and around the world. They said, oh my God, the anti-Semites are going to kill all the Jews. We've got to do something. We've got to bomb them. Knowing full well, it's just cynical politics. They know full well that that's a lie. And they oppose Iran for other reasons, but not because of its potential for having atomic weapons or something like that.
All right. Let's see here. There have been several articles published recently in Israeli and Asian newspapers about the possibility of a war breaking out soon between Israel and Iran. These articles demonize Iranian people and government and prep the Israeli citizens and the world for a war to stop an evil race looking to take over the Middle East. What are your thoughts about such a war breaking out soon with support from Saudi Arabia?
Well, I kind of addressed that before, right. But just to add a point or two new points. The Israelis are no more likely to bomb Iran than the United States. In fact, they can't and won't do it without the okey-doke from the U.S. So that's basically a U.S. decision. Mm. And the Israelis are certainly not capable of occupying Iran any more than the United States are. So, I mean, talk about an impossible situation. But they are bombing what they call Iranian military bases in Syria. And they basically have open season on whether they're military bases or simply concentrations of Iranians or an office that has some Iranians in it. They've carried out some 200 bombing raids against using the Iranian presence as the excuse in Syria. So I could see things like that or in other places going after Iranian allies in some way. But I don't think there's going to be an outright full-scale military conflict between Israel and Iran.
Okay. Now, Norman?
Just to sort of pursue that, I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, but if you try to discover or discern any thread of morality whatsoever in these foreign policies of the various nation states, it seems almost impossible to find. I mean, you have Israel aligned with Saudi Arabia.
Morality,
yes. Yeah. I mean, is this a completely total opportunistic situation? I was going to think of another cluster or something, but a situation yes. Where there's no morality whatsoever involved in all of these conflicts. Would you go that far?
The answer is yes. No, I mean, nation states don't operate, even the best of them don't operate strictly on a moral basis, and the worst of them, and that's what we've been talking about tonight, never operate on the basis of morality. They might use morality after the fact as a reason to justify. So we know that there are Democrats who are for intervention for humanitarian rights, the right to protect. We're not intervening to steal their oil, we're intervening to stop the massacre, except we stay, the massacres end, and then we steal their oil. So, people will use moral arguments, but I don't think there's actual any genuine morality, certainly not in the context of any of the countries we've talked about tonight.
Okay, let's see here now. Could you talk about the MEK and the neocons?
Okay, MEK, let me explain to folks. MEK stands for the Mujahideen e Khalq, or MEK. It's a group that had its origins in the 1970s in Iran. They combined or tried to combine Marxism with Islam. They were kind of a left-wing version of political Islam. They fought against the Shah. They took up armed struggle. They initially joined with Khomeini, the Ayatollah who ran Iran, but very quickly turned against him and started carrying out armed actions against his government, including wounding some folks and assassinating the prime minister and some other pretty serious stuff. When the Iran-Iraq war broke out, they fled to Iraq and sided with Saddam Hussein and actually fought with his troops against Iran. And that action, more than anything, has alienated the Iranian people against them because the country was at war and most Iranians felt that they had been unjustly attacked by Iraq, who was being backed by the U.S., according to them, and the MEK was fighting with the enemy. The MEK kind of morphed over the years from a quasi-left group to a openly rightist group. And they now have been currying favor with right-wing politicians in Europe and more recently in the United States. So their supporters include Newt Gingrich and John Bolton and Michael Bloomberg, as well as a few window-dressing liberals as well. And they tell these folks that, you know, we have this great popular support, the people of Iran are ready on the verge of rising up, and we're going to be the folks who come to power. So John Bolton in particular went and spoke at a big conference of the MEK in Paris, a big rally a couple months ago. And so there's a very tight connection between the neocons and the MEK, much like, do you remember Ahmed Chalabi? Does that name ring any bells? The guy who was going to take power in Iraq, when the U.S. overthrew Saddam Hussein, he was the chosen guy by the Pentagon who was going to come in and run things for the U.S., except he had no popular base of support either. And if it ever gets to that point, it'll be obvious that the MEK does not have anything like the base of support that they claim.
As I remember, someone who picked up a check, $25,000, I believe, from the MEK, was Howard Dean. Yeah. So all the Deaniacs can reflect on the liberal gloss that Howard Dean put over the MEK.
Yeah.
Excuse me. Now, you have a section in your book that says, or talks about his nuclear power Islamic. Mm-hmm. I just want to read a short excerpt here. Shortly after coming to power, Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini scrapped the Shah's nuclear power program as un-Islamic. In fact, he called nuclear power the work of the devil. Not coincidentally, the United States and Europeans had completely halted their devil's work in Iran. Germany had stopped construction on the Bushehr nuclear reactor. The United States, Germany, and France had cut off supplies of equipment and nuclear material. All three governments have refused to refund any money already paid despite the cancellation of nuclear contracts, et cetera, et cetera. So you spoke about the main hostilities that the United States has towards Iran. I don't understand how, I mean, it's obvious that they don't view nuclear power as being something that they want to take it to the next step. They don't want to, you know, create nuclear weapons because it's against this religious country.
The argument in Washington is you can't believe these folks. You know, they'll issue a fatwa one day and they'll contradict it with another fatwa the next day. So just because he made that statement doesn't mean anything. That's the argument. Right. Actually, I think it has a little bit more weight than not. I've actually discussed the question because you have the question of nuclear weapons on the one hand, and I think they absolutely do not have any plans, nor have they had plans to develop nuclear weapons. Partly, I think, is morality and their interpretation of Islam, and part of it is just realpolitik. It's actually very difficult to develop nuclear weapons. You need more than enriched uranium. You need to miniaturize it. You need to know how to detonate it. You need to know how to put it on a ballistic missile. And all of that can be discovered while you're doing it, and it then opens up Iran to being attacked by Israel and the United States. So for both moral and practical reasons, they're not developing nuclear weapons. The second issue is nuclear power. And they have resumed nuclear power. Now they have the Bushehr reactor running. It's producing about 1% of the country's electricity. And I've had a very interesting discussion with the Iranians about nuclear power. Norman is a veteran of the anti-nuclear power movement here. And I suspect many people in the audience tonight are not real keen on nuclear power because of the problems and the waste it generates and all the other problems, safety issues, or like being, who would build a nuclear reactor on an earthquake fault, for example?
Well, you know, PG&E we've seen is impeccable in its technological capacities in the last week. Yeah.
Exactly. Diablo Canyon, in case people didn't get the reference, it's Diablo Canyon, is built on an earthquake, and they knew it when they built it. The debate in Iran, first of all, there is much more debate now than there used to be. Again, this is just based on my random interviews with people on the street. And one of the big issues is the tremendous cost. You know, nuclear power is really, really expensive. And in this country, the power companies will not build nuclear plants without having massive subsidies from the government and guaranteed insurance, so when the thing blows up, they don't have to pay for it. Well, Iran faces the same difficulty. And what happened in Fukushima had an impact on the Iranian public. So I would say that the government has done a pretty good job of convincing people that nuclear power is needed, and there still is considerable support for that. But I also detect a lot more opposition to it than in the past. And it could be that there would be at some point an anti-nuke power movement in Iran. That would be an interesting development.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. I remember, this was 2005, but I became a bit of a joke with my traveling companions because I had only two questions for people in the street. Do you support nuclear power for the Iranian government, and do you support nuclear weapons? And it was an almost complete split. Virtually everyone said they supported nuclear power, and virtually none of them said they'd support nuclear weapons.
Right, yeah, that was 2005, and it has changed, interestingly enough.
So, and what? How would you calibrate how much it's changed? You think there's more opposition now to nuclear power?
Yes, it's changed in that way, but how many, It's not easy to do opinion polls, and I make no pretense that if I stop 10 or 20 people randomly on the street, that's some kind of scientific poll. It could be coincidence. But for sure, I have sensed from both the random interviews and also with some like newspaper editors and other folks that I know in Iran, there's more opposition to nuclear power now than there was before. Mm-hmm. How much? I don't know.
Interesting. Yeah, so you two went to Iran together in 2005.
Yep.
So
that was the one with Sean Penn.
With Sean Penn.
That was the first Ahmadinejad election, as it turned out.
Yeah.
And I remember that they had a runoff. And at first, it was sort of like here, there was it Mostafa Moin, was basically a liberal civil liberties candidate. And we went, I think, to a rally in the stadium, and we could have been a Berkeley rally for a left-wing candidate. It was amazing energy, thousands of people there rallying for women's rights, for civil liberties. And Moin, I think, did not come in first or second. He came in more like third or fourth.
Yeah.
And so the centrist candidate, Rafsanjani, made the runoff. So I think we had a driver who, the day after the first round election, took the Moin bumper sticker off and put a Rafsanjani bumper sticker on. But then unfortunately, Rafsanjani, who was sort of a centrist corporate hack, lost in the runoff to Ahmadinejad, who had your book chronicles quite extensively, was sort of a, roughly speaking, a Trump sort of phony populist who turned out to be a ripoff artist. And maybe you should talk about Ahmadinejad.
Yeah, he was a crook, among other problems. Yeah. No, they call Ahmadinejad the Trump of Iran.
Wow.
Or maybe they call Trump the Ahmadinejad. Anyway, you got the idea. He ran as a straight-up populist. So I'm going to put the profits from Iran's oil on the kitchen table of every Iranian. He made those kind of promises. And the reformists had been in power for the previous 8 years. And they had partly, well-intentioned, they hadn't made the kind of changes that people wanted. They hadn't, because the military and the intelligence services still, and the judiciary still controlled a lot of what went on in civil society. So the reformists were unable to make this kind of significant changes that people wanted. Plus, the economy was not doing as well as people wanted. And the Trumpy type person stepped in. And he did things like lower tuition costs for university students. He provided a guaranteed a wage for everybody, a very small one. It wasn't like what we're talking about here, but it was a subsidy. And various in Iran, you get a subsidy when you get married from the government, or a loan, which oftentimes is not paid back. So he increased that amount. So these were all very popular steps in the early days, until the inflation set in and the other economic problems. And the level of corruption was the same or bigger than before. And a couple of his very high-level associates, like cabinet ministers, vice president, are now in jail doing time for corruption. And he keeps wanting, so by the end of his second term, he was completely discredited. Inflation had hit, I think, 40, 45% at one point. I mean, he was really, and all of his populist programs were shown to have been phony, and he's pretty much disgraced, which, by the way, does not deter him from trying to run for president again. Every once in a while, he'll float some interviews in the media or do something, show up at an event to indicate that he might run. But remember, Iran, the Iranian democracy means that there's a committee that determines if you're Islamic enough to run, and apparently he's not, because they're never allowing him to run and are not likely to.
Here's a broader question. I mean, as I remember, when I got back from that election, I ran into some people on the left who thought that Ahmadinejad was a great result because it was a sort of a pretzel version of enemy, my enemy is my friend. He was against the international monetary system, or there was some rationale. Yeah. And it makes me, and you've been to 40 or 50 countries, I think, right, reporting, and I wonder how much you've run into, well, give me another example. I have never been to Libya, but I've heard people on the left say, oh, well, Gaddafi really anti-imperialist, he was anti-US. And then when you look at it, he ran torture chambers. So I wonder how much you've encountered sharp contrast between what you saw and reported in various countries, and then you come back and you hear verdicts that are quite different.
Yes, that does happen. By the way, I've visited 97 countries altogether. So we can take the example of Ahmadinejad. In 2009, you may recall, there were these huge demonstrations. 3 million people marched in the streets of Tehran and the other major cities, protesting the elections. This is Ahmadinejad's second term. A lot of people thought it was vote fraud, but they were very much upset with the system and with Ahmadinejad in particular. And there were some on the left, not most, but some here in the US, who defended Ahmadinejad and said that the Green Movement was a CIA plot. And they linked it to US efforts for colored revolutions in Georgia or Armenia, or the run-up to the overthrow of Salvador Allende in Chile. They said the CIA does these things, so they must be doing it here too. The problem was they had absolutely no facts to back it up. And I wrote an article at the time, actually got very wide circulation, pointing out this was a genuine mass movement that had different political trends within it, but this was no plot by the CIA. Then the fun thing about sticking to a topic over a long period of time is you can go back and revisit some of these things. So I actually went back. The WikiLeaks released all the diplomatic cables that the U.S. Had about that movement in 2009. And I went back and read them. So there would have been some hint that the CIA, remember, these are all classified cables that were never supposed to see the light of day. There would have been some hint or something about outside interference, what they could do. You know what they were? They were cables of them talking to journalists, people like myself, well, not me personally, but journalists, to find out what was really going on. They had no embassy in Tehran, and so, which it really was a den of spies, because that's where one of the main listening posts the CIA uses is the US embassy in a given country. And it turns out the British had set up a phony website to try and attract protesters and then cull their personal information for later use to try and find them as spies. But it was only open 9 to 5 London time. And there were no Farsi speakers. So it wasn't the most successful effort at undermining the popular movement in Iran. So, you have to look at each of these folks in their particulars. What do they do? What are their policies? What are the human rights policies? But also, what are their economic policies? People like Gaddafi and Assad in Syria were carrying out neoliberal policies. They had given up Arab socialism long ago and were implementing the policies that were designed to endear them to the West. But they nevertheless faced movements that led to their, certainly in the case of Gaddafi, to his demise. And ultimately, it was the foreign intervention by the French, the British, and the U.S. that led to Gaddafi's overthrow. But just because somebody is being attacked by the United States doesn't make them good. You have to look at what they're actually doing in the terms of internationally and for the people of their country.
Okay, so I'm going to try to read this. I hope I get it right. Can you see a useful role for the United Nations, including any of its agencies, the IAEA, the World Bank, the High Commission for Human Rights, etc., as intermediaries on discrete issues of the moment?
Yes, there's a role. The humanitarian groups that the UN has do very good work in my direct observation. UNESCO, UNRWA, various other agencies that provide refugee, the UNHCR, the folks who handle refugees. I visit UN-run camps in Jordan and various other parts of the world, in Congo and elsewhere. You know, it's very, very difficult, especially when you have poverty, lack of facilities, basic water, sanitation, and they've developed an expertise and are very good at it and can actually help people with time and enough money to ameliorate their conditions. I mean, what you really need is a political settlement for people to be able to go home, but short of that, these agencies do a good job. The other ones, everything is political. So when the IAEA was run by the Egyptian,
El Baradei.
He was, he was a mainstream politician from Egypt, and he later went back to try and run for president of Egypt after Mubarak was overthrown. But when he was head of the IAEA, he would not knuckle under to the Bush administration's demands. And Bush wanted him to say Iran had a nuclear weapons program to justify sanctions, and he wouldn't do it. If you go back and look at all of the reports that were issued during that time, there were all kinds of questions about Iran's program, but there was never any claim that it had a nuclear weapons program. When Yuki Amano came in as the head of the IAEA, he's a Japanese politician, he was much more favorable to the U.S., and the U.S. leaned on him very hard to try and come up with some reports. And even he, although much, he definitely ratcheted up the pressure on Iran much more. But even then, the IAEA never said Iran had a functioning nuclear weapons program that threatened the region or the U.S. or whatever. So, the UN is political like every other international institution. The World Bank and the IMF function to promote U.S.-style capitalism in various parts of the world. It's not neutral. It's not just an aid organization. So I think you have to look at each. And of course, the Security Council is highly political and subject to U.S. vetoes and vetoes by others when they don't like the policy. So I think it's nothing close to what people had hoped for at the end of World War II when it was first set up. But yes, it does some useful things.
Reese, while we've got you here, just between us, let me ask you a question about journalism with foreign correspondents, that is, correspondents who are reporting to and through U.S. media outlets. I remember, I think you were at a gathering in a hotel, and it was in Kabul in 2009, and Anand Gopal was there, the reporter at that time for the Wall Street Journal, and he was saying, well, my editors are saying the stories have to get shorter and shorter, and he was having less and less space, and then he eventually left that paper and wrote this brilliant book called No Good Man Among the Living, which is a brilliant, as I say, book, where he just traveled around Afghanistan and talked to people, and he tells a story so different than the mass media tell about Afghanistan. And you've been to so many countries, traveled by yourself, but also, I remember, in Iraq, you traveled before the invasion with, I think you crossed paths with Nick Kristof at the New York Times and others, and you've written about how almost without exception, those mainline reporters assume that the U.S. has the prerogative, maybe not the wisdom at a particular time, but the prerogative to intervene in other countries. Now, how is that for you when you've got a different attitude?
Yeah, I've run into problems with an editor or two over the years. It is very hard when you're in the field reporting, trying to report accurately, when everybody else is reporting it differently. It's actually easier if you're in a country which is not under the glare of spotlight at the moment. And so there's kind of more different views that are out there. Mm-hmm. But I'll give you two examples. In Iraq when we were there in 2002, which was just a matter of months before the U.S. was going to invade. We knew war was coming. We couldn't tell you what the date was going to be, but everybody knew, all of us knew. The Iraqis weren't so sure. And to report at that point that, for example, Iraq had no weapons of mass destruction, impossible. You simply could not do it for a mainstream publication because they would say it didn't matter how much documentation you had, what sources you had. Why? Because everybody knows they have weapons of mass destruction. And the opposite would have been also true. At one point, I found out that there, from a UN source actually, that there was a shortage of chlorine between the records of what was imported to the country and what they actually counted when it was inside the country. And it could have been an accounting error, or it could have been somebody was using chlorine to make chlorine bombs. And if I had written a story that said the fact that there was missing chlorine and found some professor or somebody in the United States who would say, oh, well, that means they were likely making chlorine weapons, that would have been a front page story. It would have been false. But if I had tried the opposite and said, there's actually a logical explanation for why this chlorine is missing, like they used it in too many swimming pools, I don't know, whatever the explanation was, then that story would have not run. So particularly in times of crisis, the ability for the reporter to report something outside the very narrow perimeters is very difficult. And it's not just the editors. Sometimes I've worked with very progressive editors from other countries, radio networks particularly, and who are willing to entertain stronger criticisms of U.S. policy. But then they get subject to blitzes from outside forces. An example, I wrote a story from Iran about the Jewish community in Iran. And this was, Iran has the second largest Jewish community in a Muslim country, or the third largest in the Middle East. It goes Israel, Turkey, Iran. So there's somewhere around 12 to 20,000 Jews still living in Iran. And at the time I was reporting, the nuclear accord had been agreed to but not ratified or not agreed to by either side yet. And so I wanted to know what was the opinion of the Jewish community in Tehran, and how did that compare with Netanyahu, who was, of course, adamantly opposed to it. So I did the same thing I always do. I went to some kosher restaurants, I went to some temples, I went to stop people on the street, and got to talk to Jewish community leaders. There's a Jewish representative to the parliament. I interviewed all these folks and wrote up my story. And basically it was, the Jews of Tehran, like pretty much everybody else in Tehran, wants the nuclear accord, and they disagree with Netanyahu. Well, I was attacked up and down by some right-wing press, and there was some obscure website who wrote an article, because the article ended up getting published in USA Today. And some guy in his pajamas wrote an article attacking me, and in it he said, the logic was, Iran is a totalitarian society, nobody can speak their mind, therefore nobody can talk honestly to a reporter, therefore the Jews support Netanyahu. That was the logic of his article. And I later found out the name of this news website was Breitbart News, which I had never heard of at the time. But it gives you some idea of the quality of their journalism. So you can run into problems from the editors, but even if you do get published, you can run into attacks from the outside. Now, in this case, the editors were very principled. They let me actually write a response to Breitbart and some others, which they ran. USA Today didn't. It was very interesting. The USA Today ran three of my stories from Iran. This was through PRI, Public Radio International, but it was Global Post at the time. Anyway, they were print stories. The USA Today liked the three stories about Iran, but they wouldn't run my response to the attack by the right wing. But the PRI did, to their credit, and I was able to respond in a timely way.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit, unless you wanted to add on to that, Norman.
Oh, no, I sort of echo the commendation from Senator Skinner. I mean, to remain an independent reporter, it's an amazing journey in itself, and I wonder, how you, how you would sum up the unsum-upable, which is you started out
quickly
in 68, and you're here in, what, 2018, last time I checked? Overall, quick summary of the changes in the terrain and how you've navigated?
It's been great. I wouldn't do it any differently. I am unusual in the world of journalism because I never took any classes in journalism. I didn't work. I never took a job at a local daily or anything like that. I got trained at Ramparts and then pretty much freelanced after that. But I came out of an activist background. So my first commitment was not to making a living as a journalist. I mean, I wanted to, and I have, but my first commitment is to truth and to telling the story as it really is. And if that means I don't get paid for something or a story doesn't get published or I have to take a story that should have run in a daily paper and take it to the Progressive magazine or 48hills.org or someone like that, so be it. You know, something, what I write, if it's any, it'll get published somewhere if it's any good. I would prefer to get it published in mass circulation publications or radio outlets, and I do. I still write for those folks and air and broadcast for them, and it's good because it gets the message out to a wider number of people. But it's like when you go into a job, if you're going to stick to your principles, you have to be willing to quit. And you may never quit. You may stick with the job, but if you're willing to quit on a question of principle, then they have no power over you. Mm-hmm. And that's been my guiding light in freelancing as well.
That's right. Let's see.
I think we should call it to a question. Sure.
One more question. We have the, in 2015, the JCPOA was signed, and it's been trashed. There's a section in your book where you say, this is what I would do if I were president. Let's just wrap it up with that. What would you do, Reese Ehrlich?
You know, or Secretary of State or something like that. The first thing I'd have to do is resign, right? Outdo Sir Scaramucci for a short term in power. What I would do is implement a non-intervention policy around the world. And I'd have to figure out priorities. Maybe it would be Israel and Palestine, or maybe it would be Iran, or pull the troops out of Korea. I don't know. It depends on what's going on at the time. But make a firm commitment to stop all U.S. military intervention, close U.S. military bases, and among other things, use that money to benefit the people of this country who are much in need of healthcare and education and infrastructure and all the things we seem to never have any money to pay for because it's all being wasted in overseas adventures and militarism. And the argument is, how can you just pull out? Because doesn't that leave a vacuum? If you pull out of Iran and Syria and Iraq, why the Ruskies or the Chinese or somebody else is going to come in? And my argument to that is, well, first of all, there's nobody that is a superpower like the U.S. You're going to see probably several countries competing for influence. Nobody has the military and economic clout that the U.S. has and the ability to do evil. And that secondly, let's even say Iran expends its influence in Syria or Iraq because the U.S. has pulled out. Well, you know, after the people of Iraq are pretty angry not only at the U.S. for its occupation, but they're angry at Iran as well. The Muqtada al-Sadr, who won the largest number of votes in the last parliamentary elections, ran on a campaign opposing the U.S. and Iran. And the demonstrations in Basra, in the south of Iraq, just a matter of a few months ago, were attacking both the U.S. and the Iranian consulates there. So I'm confident that if the U.S. somehow did manage to pull out entirely from a place like Iraq, the people of Iraq would not stand for domination by Iran any more than they would by the U.S. And I think, you know, that anti-interventionism is a perfectly reasonable, coherent, good policy that could be carried out.
I want to remind people that Reese's book is here, and to thank everybody this evening for being here.
That's all right. The Iran Agenda Today. This is a great book. If you're a teacher, you definitely want to buy it for your classroom and get the real story about what's happening or what has happened in Iran and what's going on today. Reese Ehrlich, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, everybody.
What an education. And he's going to be here signing. You're going to sign the books, right?
I'm going to sign the books.
He's going to sign the books.